This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Congressman Khanna taking your calls for the hour and the last hour. It was fascinating. On the line with us right now is Ryan Grimm. He is the D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept, the co-founder of Strong Arm Press, co-publisher and author of the Mueller Papers. You can tweet him at Ryan Grimm, R-Y-A-N-G-R-I-M, and strongarmpress.com is the website. Ryan, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
It has. It's been too long.
It's great to have you on. So you've published the Mueller Papers. Right. What is this? What's the significance of this? Where'd you get the information? You know, just tell us all about it, please.
Right. Well, one little clarification. I'm not actually the author. The technical author, I suppose, would be Robert Mueller.
Right.
Along with a number of, I'm sure he has ghostwriters in his office who are helping him put it together. But, you know, as it became clear that there was at least a possibility that the Mueller report will not see the light of day, or at least might have to be leaked in order to see the light of day, at Strong Arm Press, we started thinking, well, wait a minute, well, he's actually been publishing pieces of the Mueller report over the last kind of year and a half. You know, each indictment, each sentencing memo, you know, is going to be the fodder that he uses to eventually put together his report. Now, his report, who knows what it's going to have in it. But if you want to know the grist that he's developed that has been able to be turned into actual indictments, because that's what, you know, the rest of it is interesting, and we should, you know, it's nice to know what all of these different actors and operatives were up to. But if you're curious what the actual crimes are that Mueller has found, it doesn't appear that he's going to find any more. Now, he could always surprise us with a last-minute massive sweeping indictment and roundup of half the city. But these are the characters that he's put before judges so far, and all of those indictments are public. They are a real pain to read, though. You have to go searching around, finding the PDFs, download the PDFs. You read it for two pages. If you go away from a PDF on your phone, forget about it. You know, you'll never find your place in there.
Sure.
Again. And so, I for one had meant to read a ton of these, but just had never gotten around to it. I said, "Oh, I've heard that indictment's actually a good read. I'm going to read it." And then days go by, and I don't. So what we did is we just found them all, formatted them, and put our own Mueller report out, so to speak.
That's extraordinary. You know, there was some speculation that Mueller expected that there would be such opposition to his findings being made public that one of the ways that he has found to get around this this anticipated problem, particularly watching, you know, what Nixon did back in the 70s and, you know, nearly successfully, that the way that he was going to do this was basically by leaking everything he's finding in the form of these specific indictments, these criminal indictments. There's been over 100 of them, have there not?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. And it serves two purposes. So on the one hand, he gets the information out. You know, so people who want to say, well, there were no crimes committed, well, here are the crimes. People want to say, well, nobody's been indicted for a crime of collusion. That's absolutely true. That's correct. You know, what we have is a lot of peripheral stuff at this point. So it serves his purpose to get it out. President Trump can't stop him from filing a sentencing memo or filing an indictment, but it also kind of whets the appetite of the public, and it makes it harder for people then, to suppress the ultimate report. Paradoxically, though, I think it will also, if the final report is published, take some of the air out of it. In other words, you know, if you read this book that we put together called the Mueller Papers, if you read it cover to cover, you come away and be, this is a staggering crime. This is an extraordinary cast of incompetent criminals who came together. And, you know, they should all be tossed out and locked up. But then you realize, well, I kind of knew a lot of this stuff already.
Right.
And that's how it is likely to be reported if there isn't much new in the Mueller report. There'll be this insane amount of criminality that is exposed in the report. But because we already know about so much of the criminality, it'll be said, well, nothing new here.
Yeah, it's like the drip, drip, drip has kind of inured us to it. And then on top of that, Trump and Giuliani go out and, well, yeah, of course I did, you know, X, Y, Z. Well, of course, you know, there's nothing wrong. You know, there's nothing wrong with taking help from the Russians, you know, et cetera. And you know, at a certain level, I mean, you know, even Nixon wasn't that sociopathic and brazen. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. We're talking with Ryan Grimm. He's the co-founder of the Strong Arm Press, co-publisher of the Mueller Papers. StrongArmPress.com is the website. Ryan, what are the? I mean, you know, you're pretty well informed. I think I am, and the listeners of this program, by and large, are on the in terms of the day-to-day stuff that's been going on for a year or so of you know Mueller's various indictments. But what were the things, or what are the things, that people would find in this book, the Mueller Papers, that you found or refound, you know, as you point out, we kind of all rediscover these things, found or refound that are the most shocking to you, the most amazing, the most breathtaking?
Right. I mean, so much of it is so good. And we even included a blurb from Jeffrey Toobin, the New Yorker, calling the Mueller sentencing memos are novelistic in quality. Because, just think about this. Roger Stone is not even an extraordinary figure in this crew because they're all such extraordinary figures. To me, when I was going back through it, the indictments, which were sort of pointless but served to get it into the public record, the indictments of the dozen-plus Russian operatives, that indictment is fascinating to read because it relies on both intelligence as well as the as well as the investigation that they did to put together a narrative of how the GRU goes about trying to sow discord in a foreign country. I say it's pointless because what are the chances that these guys are going to actually show up for their court date? It's not strong, but it does. But to your earlier point, it gets it out there in public. And this is not something that Putin has done exclusively for Trump or even exclusively for the United States. This is a Russian foreign policy tactic to go in and sow chaos in the domestic politics of countries that it wants to kind of bring down. Russia very much sees geopolitics as a zero-sum game. And so if they can screw up the UK and mess around with Brexit, then they win. If they can screw up France and fund some right-wing fascist party, then they win. If they can boost some right-wing party in Germany, then they win. In their minds, they win. And so it's important to understand what are the mechanics behind this. And that particular indictment, goes through how they create fake social media accounts, how they seed articles, how they then pay to boost these articles. It goes into their attempts to convert that into protests on the ground and shows them utterly incapable of doing that. They can build a Black Lives Matter Facebook page, and they can schedule a protest, but they can't get more than two or three people to show up, which shows you need real organizing, to actually build social movements in a country, which shouldn't be surprising to anybody who's been involved in organizing. But you don't need that if you're just trying to throw junk everywhere and kind of throw dust in people's eyes. So, that one in particular was an interesting read to see how Russia sees its role in these shenanigans.
Fascinating stuff. The new book is The Mueller Papers. It's a compilation of all the public documents here that most of us have forgotten about, never read, overlooked, just heard about, and apparently a hell of a shocking read. Ryan Grimm, the co-publisher. Ryan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. StrongArmPress.com is the website. Ryan Grimm is the Twitter handle.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls in just a few minutes. It's 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Joe in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching us on YouTube.
Yeah, hi, Tom. What's been on my mind for a while, and I just wanted to get this out into the mix is, you know, in 2020, Koch Industries is going to run this Trump's campaign on the word socialism. I mean, that's what I'm seeing. It really doesn't go any further than that.
I think you're right.
And the word socialism really contained, it's a nine-letter word. Socialist is a nine-letter word. And by themselves, they contain absolutely no information. And my bone is with the media, MSNBC, and the people who are going to give you this American election again in 2020. And they're not going to, I mean, it's time for the Democrats somehow to stand up to that media. And when the word socialism and the word socialist is used, to call it out as containing absolutely no information, please give us some information. Yeah. What are you talking about when you use this word?
The two things that I think are hugely missing here, Joe, are number one, the actual dictionary definition, the primary definition of socialism is what Karl Marx defined, which is the government controlling the means of production and distribution of goods and services. And nobody in the Democratic Party is calling for that. That is, you know, what the Soviet Union did. It's what China does, you know, et cetera. So pure socialism is not what people are calling for. But what democratic socialism is and what American socialism is and has been labeled as such, frankly, by the Republican Party since the 1930s, is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, long-term unemployment insurance, food stamps. All of these things are American socialism. And that fact never gets mentioned on TV. And then the flip side of that, the thing that makes me equally crazy, and I was watching this last week. I watched about 15 minutes of Morning Joe as I was getting ready, you know, morning getting out of the house. And him and Donnie Deutsch were having this thing about, well, I'm a capitalist, you're a capitalist. Why won't Jay Inslee say that he's a capitalist? As I recall, I think it was Jay Inslee. It was one of the presidential candidates who wouldn't say that he was a capitalist. No, it was John Hickenlooper. John Hickenlooper wouldn't say that he was a capitalist. He was like, why won't he say he's a capitalist? And I'm like, you know, capitalist, I mean, look it up in the dictionary. A capitalist is a person who lives off of or benefits from capital. That is to say, a person who makes money with money. There are probably not more than, you know, 100,000 capitalists, true capitalists, maybe a couple hundred thousand in the United States. People who literally are living off their trust funds, people who are literally living off their investments. There are very, very few of those people. The rest of us are workers, right, who are working or we're on a pension or something, but that's not capitalism. And for these people to think that being a businessman, I mean, I've been a businessman for 50 years. I've owned my own businesses for 50 years. I've never been a capitalist. I've never made money with money. I make money off my own work. So it's like these two words, socialism and capitalism, the media does just a terrible job of using either one of them, and it makes me nuts. So I'm with you, Joe. Well, thanks a lot for the call. It's coming up on 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have covered so much territory today. Congressman Ro Khanna, of course, the whole last hour, all kinds of topics that he opened up for us. I started out the program pointing out that Donald Trump has just basically, come out with this insane budget that is going to give the military $34 billion more than they asked for, billion with a B, which many of us are speculating is going to become his little personal slush fund now that he's figured out that he can take money out of the military budget by declaring an emergency. And $2.7 trillion in cuts to social safety net programs over the next decade. Donald Trump, who tweeted during the campaign that he was the only Republican who pledged not to cut Medicaid, is proposing to cut $1.1 trillion from Medicaid. So if you're on Medicaid or you know anybody who is on Medicaid or you think that someday when you are in your later years and you may need to go to a nursing home or something, or hospice care, those are typically covered by Medicaid. Get ready, because Donald Trump wants to take $1 trillion out of Medicaid, which is going to, in all probability, come out of your hide. This is after he just took $1.5 trillion, borrowed it from our grandchildren, and gave it to the richest 0.01% of Americans and the big corporations. He wants to cut $327 billion from anti-poverty programs. He wants to cut $207 billion out of student loan programs, make Betsy DeVos very, very happy. And he wants to cut $200 billion from the Federal Retirement and Postal Service programs. This is mind-boggling, right? $2 trillion that he wants to cut while he is increasing the Pentagon budget by $34 billion a year to over $700 and some odd billion. And the question I was asking, Eugene Robinson wrote a piece a couple of days ago for the Washington Post, in which he said, and I quote, "He apparently believes his loyal supporters are the dumbest, most gullible people on earth. We'll see if he's right," he being Donald Trump. Harry Truman back in the day talked about this as well. And Harry Truman had some very specific words to tell us about the Republican Party. Here's the clip.
"I've been studying the Republican Party for over 12 years at close hand in the capital of the United States. And by this time, I have discovered where the Republicans stand on most of the major issues. Since they won't tell you themselves, I'm going to tell you. They approve the American farmer, but they're willing to help him go broke. They stand four square for the American home, but not for housing. They are strong for labor, but they are stronger for restricting labor's rights. They favor a minimum wage. The smaller the minimum, the better. They endorse educational opportunity for all, but they won't spend money for teachers or for schools. They think modern medical care and hospitals are fine for people who can afford them. They approve of Social Security benefits, so much so that they took them away from almost 1 million people."
So there you go, Harry Truman. You know, yeah, what did he say? You know, they say I'm giving them hell. Actually, I tell the truth and they think it's hell. And that's exactly what he did. But I mean, the bigger point, that was 1948. I was not even alive in 1948, and odds are you weren't either. And Harry Truman had the number of the Republican Party, and here we are today, and it's the exact same scam. They're still running this scam. They are the party of the rich and powerful, pretending to be the power of the working person, or the party of the working person, excuse me. And, you know, as I pointed out, Eugene Robinson is saying, you know, Trump is campaigning, promises made, promises kept. I don't recall Mexico building the wall. In fact, I don't recall the wall even being built. Our trade deficit in goods is up at all-time high, $891 billion. Our deficit with China is a record $419 billion. He said he was going to denuclearize North Korea. Instead, Kim Jong-un ate his lunch, made a fool of him. He said he was going to revamp the Affordable Care Act and we'd all have better health care than before and it'll cost less and everybody would have it. No, that was a lie. He promised he was going to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C., and so he puts a coal lobbyist in charge of the EPA and an oil lobbyist in charge of Interior, and in his cabinet he's got a billionaire like Wilbur Ross, who Forbes magazine called a grifter, you know, who ran an offshore bank that was laundering money for oligarchs around the world. He puts a billionaire, Betsy DeVos, the owner of 10 yachts, on his, you know, who she's from Michigan, her foundation, pushing private, for-profit charter schools in Michigan so heavily, so aggressively, that about half of the schools in Michigan now are no longer public schools, and Michigan's public schools are in crisis. I mean, you know, he has assembled a cabinet of grifters, and then Rick Perry in charge of our nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, putting dumb people, basically, in charge of literally rocket science. It is shocking. So my question to you, my question from the first hour, do you think Trump supporters are actually this stupid? Or is there something else going on?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
How long are they going to continue to support him before they figure out that they've been conned? Or can right-wing hate radio and Fox News really hold this thing together for him? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple quick stories I want to share with you, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. Actually, we've got another hour and a half. I'll get to these at the top of the next hour. Say what? Oh, we only have a half hour. Oh, that's right. I'm looking at a clock that hasn't been daylight savings adjusted. So anyhow, okay, very quickly. The Trump administration is planning on using Facebook and Twitter to spy on people who are collecting federal disability payments. Honest to God, 10 million people get Social Security disability payments, and the Trump administration has decided they don't want to pay for this anymore. So if you're on disability and on your Facebook page, you have posted pictures of yourself doing something. Let's say that you're claiming that your back is bad. And on Facebook, you got a picture of yourself, mountain biking or something. They're going to take that picture and deny your claim. Now, a lot of people say you're in terrible chronic pain. But, hey, you can smile long enough for the camera. That smile may cost you your Social Security. The Trump administration, honest to God, is going after Facebook and Twitter to try to deny people their Social Security benefits and their disability benefits. In Arizona, the Republicans in the state house want to, the people of Arizona, by a 2-to-1 margin, 2/3 of the people in Arizona voted to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour next year. 2/3 of the people in Arizona voted for this. It was a ballot initiative. The legislature now is saying, oh, well, the people, the Republicans who control the legislature, oh, the people didn't really mean that. Anybody under 22 years of, anybody younger than 22 only gets $7.25 an hour. That's what's right, that legislation's right now before the Arizona House of Representatives. And the National Rifle Association has attacked Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as, quote, a self-absorbed socialist darling. Right. Brilliant. Steve in Lexington Park, Maryland. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. One thing, you and I share the same birth date. Thought you might want to know that.
Okay.
And I donated enough money to Free Speech TV, as I always do, to get your book about the Second Amendment. So I'll be looking forward to that. Now, what I caught up about is two topics. I think I might have spoken to you about this before. I do believe in changes, the changes that that the Democratic Party would like to see, but I'm in the camp that says you should take it slow. For instance, I was an elementary school teacher for 31 years, and we got a brand new young principal after 15 years working with one principal, and this principal wanted to make major changes very fast, and we on the advisory committee said, no, let's make the changes slow. We go with your change, but let's do it slow. The principal decided to make the changes real fast, and the school went in, basically for a couple of years, went into a depression because it was not a nice place to work. So I say, if you want to make changes, let's go about it slow. Let people get used to the changes before you make the next change.
Yeah, I think rather than slow or fast, I think that what we should be talking about is what is the appropriate time period. Pete Buttigieg yesterday in the town hall with CNN on Medicare for All, made the point that the way to back into that is to simply give everybody the public option tomorrow morning. So anybody who wants to buy into Medicare can, and then at actual cost, at market cost, which will be 20% below what insurance companies charge, because they're allowed by law to skim 20% off the top for stockholder dividends and profits and CEO salaries and things. And so over time, over a period of relatively short period of time, I would think, most people are going to end up buying Medicare because it's more comprehensive and it's less expensive.
Right.
Bernie, when he originally proposed it, said, let's just drop the eligibility age by 10 years every year, or by a decade every year. And that way the Medicare organization can grow, year by year, large enough to encompass these new people. That's not fast or slow, Steve. That's just, what's the appropriate speed with which do we do things? And I don't think I disagree with you on that.
Okay, also, one last thing. In the last hour, I heard the word automation being mentioned, and that right away in my head, I remember when we were kids, because we're around the same age. There was a Twilight Zone episode where Richard Deacon, I don't know if you remember him from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Mm-hmm.
He was the boss of an organization, and they were quickly replacing all the workers with robots. And then the story, and everybody complained, then the story or the show ended showing Richard Deacon in a bar. He was fired because a robot took his management boss position.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, hey, automation's fine, but management better watch out for their job.
Yeah, you're right. AI can replace white-collar jobs perhaps faster than mechanical automation can replace blue-collar jobs. Steve, great points. Mike in Millbridge, Maine. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Now, what I call for is I'm just wondering if it's my mind isn't working properly, or do people know that the Republican Party is actually a tool of the corporations and the rich? They're only there to pass legislation for the corporations and the rich, and that's all they're there for.
Well, I think about, you know, solidly 40%, 30 to 40% of Americans, those people who either are members of the Democratic Party or identify as Democrats, know that and know it well. You heard me play the Harry Truman clip from 1948. I mean, it's not like this hasn't been known. That was during my grandparents' time. it's not a secret. It's not a secret. It's just a secret if you're watching Fox News. But, of course, Fox News is owned by a billionaire, Rupert Murdoch, so he's not going to be talking about rich people, right?
Well, they have to keep at least 32% of the people in this country voting for Republicans because they gerrymander and use voter suppression.
Well, and that's why they're so hysterical about H.R. 1, the Power to the People Act that was passed out of the House of Representatives. Hmm. Mitch McConnell is now saying it'll lead to massive voter fraud. Why? Because because it allows people to vote. It's just crazy. Mike, I got to move along, but thank you, Chris in Oakland, California, listening on AM 910. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Good morning. Tom, I'd like to offer my opinion on your question from the first hour.
Sure.
And I don't believe it's any one thing. And I don't.
You mean that's causing people to follow Trump?
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. I think some of it's ignorance. And in that case, at this point, I believe that's willful ignorance. But I think it also, I think there's a number of factors. I think dogma plays into a large part of it. And I think there's a degree of Schadenfreude as well. These people, they've shown themselves to be pretty nasty and spiteful, and I think it's a lot of things, which I think is even more scary because it's more broad ranging and more insidious.
Yeah. Well, to the extent that they might be delighting in the pain of others, I'm guessing that they're delighting in the pain of others who are in their minds the other. Different from them.
It's a case of diminishing returns in their point, in their case. But I'd like to make one point before I go. I want to say something to all your listeners and to everyone and you as well. I don't want anyone ever, let you tell you that the blue wave was about wishful thinking. For me, in 2018, as it will be in 2020 and going forward, the blue wave is not wishful thinking. It is a battle cry.
Yeah.
It has to be a rallying cry, and I just urge everyone, I don't care what you hear on the news, I don't care where the polls say, you know, an hour before election closes, you've got to participate, you've got to vote, and I'm stealing your tag, it's your line, but it's so true.
Yeah.
And I wish you the very best, and I hope for the best for all of us.
Thanks, Chris.
It's in our hands, brother.
Very well said. Thank you. Vincent in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Vincent, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, in answer to the question, are Trump voters just stupid or ignorant? I've maintained for years that it's ignorance. There's one conspiracy that I believe in. I'm not a conspiracy nut, but one I do is that in the late 60s, early 70s, the dumbing down of America started happening, which allowed Ronald Reagan. We just went from dumb to dumber to dumbest, from Reagan to GW to Trump.
Well, it was sort of a two-step process. In 1976, the Supreme Court struck down 100 years of campaign finance legislation, and in particular struck down a bunch of reforms that were passed in 74 after the Nixon scandals with a decision called Buckley versus Vallejo, in which they said that if a billionaire wants to own a politician or wants to, you know, carpet bomb a community with television advertising on behalf of a politician or a ballot initiative or whatever, that they may do that without limit because money is the same thing as speech, and so it's protected by the First Amendment. 2 years later, in a decision called First National Bank versus Bilotti, they extended that from billionaires to corporations as well. So in 76, 78, basically, the Supreme Court handed our political system over to those with the most money. And then Reagan came along and in 87 stopped the Fairness Doctrine, blew up the Fairness Doctrine, which required stations when they air, editorials, their own, the opinion of the station, that they air a balanced point of view, somebody who's got the opposite point of view. And they also, and it also required radio and television stations to actually have news as a way of maintaining their licenses. And those two things were the, in my mind, those were the two major points that brought us Reaganism and that and brought us the dumbing down of the American people. And then, you know, you can add to that Bill Clinton in 96 signing the Telecommunications Act of 96, which allowed for the massive consolidation of media in the United States. And here we are. Vincent, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in about 4 minutes, Congressman Bob Ney will be dropping by to bring us up to date on what's going on in the world today. And welcome back. Let's see here. Nikki in Ansonia, Connecticut, watching us on Facebook Live. Hey, Nikki, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I just wanted to add to the previous caller about your question and saying, yes, it's ignorance, I believe, but it's also, for instance, my mother is a full-blown Trump supporter I found out. Yes. And
does she watch Fox News? Is that where she got it?
She listens to Rush Limbaugh.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes. And Fox, I'm sure. And it's not only that, it's, you know, it's her age. We lived in California most of my life. And we had Mexicans around us. I'm from Big Sur. I grew up on the Monterey Peninsula. I believe she's very smart. She had her own business. She was a beautician all of her life. And now she moved back to East. Hmm. And all of a sudden she's afraid. She's afraid. And she worked hard all of her life. And she's racist now, Tom.
Oh, my.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
So, like I'm saying, she's smart, and so it's both.
Yeah. Over the weekend, I think it was Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN on Sunday morning. He had on a professor of neuroscience who said that there is this part of the brain, a little tiny part of the brain, it's on both sides of both hemispheres, it's called the insula. And what it does is it produces disgust, and it's designed as a survival mechanism so that if you look at a plate of food and it's got maggots in it, you're disgusted. So you don't eat the food. You don't make the mistake of eating the food. Or if you bite into an apple and it's rotten, you're disgusted and you spit it out. And that in every other mammal, the insula serves that purpose. And it does primarily for us as well. But as social animals, we have learned that if you can cause somebody to think of another person or group of people as being a them rather than an us, it will activate the insula. It'll activate that part of the brain that produces this extraordinary, deep, powerful sense of disgust. And that then will cause people to engage in behavior like the Hutsis, I'm mispronouncing that, killing off the Tutsis, you know, in Rwanda. I mean, literally neighbor going after neighbor with a hatchet, or in the early United States, the slaughter of the Native Americans, or for that matter, slavery. All of these forms of genocide and mass insanity are made possible because of that little part of the brain called the insula, because of this revulsion response. And he said that neuroscientists have figured out that there's actually a series of words, of thought pictures that you can lay on people that specifically activate the insula and thus produce things like the Holocaust, you know, and all these other horrible social ills, and that we need to be fighting back against this. But I think that the Republicans have figured this out and have raised it to an art form. And that's how people become racists, is that, you know, that part of the brain becomes activated. Nikki, I'm very sorry to hear about your mother. I wish you the very best. Thanks for calling and sharing your story with us. It's great to hear from you. We'll be right back. It's 49 minutes past the hour. Okay, let's check in with Bob Ney and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, a new book by Ellen Ratner. And on the line with us is the author of Sideswiped, former Congressman Bob Ney. Bob, what's up in the world today?
Well, hi, Tom. Thank you, Bob. Well, there's a few things going on. Of course, you know, there's the story about the 737s that are being downed by the airlines themselves. So that's kind of an event affecting the world.
Yeah, as a pilot, I basically what happened, it seems, is that Boeing redesigned the 737 to make it bigger and carry more passengers, but they didn't want to call it a new airplane because then there would be a whole set of, you know, new regulations and new training requirements and everything else. But because these engines were larger and they were forward of the wing where they used to be, they tended on climb-out at full power to push the nose down. And pull the nose up, rather, excuse me, which can cause a plane to stall out. So they built this automatic mechanism to push the nose down with these sensors, all new to this airplane. And the problem in my mind, this is called the MCAT or MCAS system. The problem with it is, as a pilot, this makes me crazy, that they overrode the ability of the pilot to push the yoke or to pull the yoke back, to pull the nose back up. It just, you know, the software just ignores what the pilot is doing, you know, and the pilot's like fighting with the plane, and you've got to reach down and turn off these two switches to disable the system. In other words, it's an opt-out system, and it should have been an opt-in system. And
you know so much about that. You've given me much more to go on this afternoon than I've been able to dig up.
Yeah, well, I'm a pilot, and I've been reading the pilot message boards, and you know, there's a bunch of freaked out pilots, I can tell you, because there's three different United States airlines that are using these airplanes.
Wow, that is terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that.
And it was all. You know, it looks like it was all about saving money. On Boeing's part, they didn't want to call it a new model, and on the airline's part, they were happy to go along calling it the 737 MAX, and that way they didn't have to pay for more training for their pilots. And the result has been a disaster. Two disasters now, apparently.
Wow, that's terrible.
As far as we know. Now, keep in mind, this is my opinion. The reporter here, you are. So anyhow, what else is going on?
I know, but you've given me a lot of good information. I appreciate that.
Sure.
I really do. Speaking of the big boys and money, presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is looking at a trust-busting plan, and it's aimed at Silicon Valley mergers. Now, Silicon Valley, Tom, because I called and asked for some reaction, you know, from some people around the Hill, and they said, well, Silicon Valley is ignoring it. It's not going to happen. It's Elizabeth Warren, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Except if Donald Trump won a presidency, you don't know who's going to win the presidency. And if there were a takeover and there's 22 seats up in the Senate and you had a Democratic, you know, majority in the House, Senate, and the president, then this is something that, even if it didn't go through, the big Silicon Valley people, you know, the Facebooks of the world, Apple, Walmart, et cetera,
Google,
people were involved in this. You know, Google, yes, would have to, I think, at least pay attention. Now, the president wouldn't be able to do it by, some type of executive order. But again, it's something that, you know, technically could happen. And let's face it, something about Silicon Valley, have they not called things wrong in the past? Have they not had a tin ear, as they say in the reports, when it comes to its consequences?
Well, and the situation's gotten as bad as it has because back in the 70s, there was a Supreme Court decision, I think it was GTE Sylvania, in which the Supreme Court adopted a policy that had been promoted for about 15 years by Robert Bork. This was before the disastrous nomination to put him on the court when he was still a respected jurist, and that antitrust legislation should not look at the impact of trust on competition, on small businesses, on communities, any of those things that it was originally designed for, that it should only look at the impact of the price that the consumer pays. And that has been the standard that both the Justice Department and the Supreme Court have upheld since the mid-70s. And it's completely crazy, in my opinion. I'm writing a book on this, actually. And,
how are you?
And if that Supreme Court decision is not overturned or legislation is not passed that would render that Supreme Court decision moot, then Elizabeth Warren is going to have a challenge doing the kind of antitrust, doing the kind of trust busting she wants. So I'm guessing that she's hoping to pull some legislation together to go along with it.
I would assume, and that's why she's coming out with this, because when people said, well, it's worthless for what she's doing, well, that's not actually accurate, because there's a lot of scenarios, and you're giving the court case example, and then also, depending on who is running the show in D.C., there could be a lot of different things that, several balls up in the air. So I think she's trying to, just get the idea out there at least.
Yep.
I don't think it's just a campaign event.
Oh, no, this is something we need as a nation. We need this.
Substantive idea out there.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Small entrepreneurs have been just squashed out of business. And now, even if you're going to start a business, the business model is build it up to the point where you can sell it off to one of the giants before they squash you like a bug. The idea of, starting a family hardware store and passing it down to your grandchildren is just dead.
Absolutely. Yes. Oh, something else that's dead is the White House budget. It's dead upon arrival.
Yeah.
Arrives on Capitol Hill. Something of interest I noted in there is that the president stayed away from Social Security and Medicare.
But he wants to cut $1 trillion out of Medicaid.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, over a decade. That's mind-boggling. Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And thank you for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Still an hour early with this crazy daylight savings time. At least we've got Ro Khanna on our side. He wants to do away with it. That was an interesting conversation. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon. And don't forget, democracy, in particularly, as fragile as it all is right now, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.